Two Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
You know, being in my 70s, I'm thinking I should still have a pair of purple wide whale corduroy bell bottoms. I lost them a long time ago. So, hey, listen, now I'm going to get Patty and Bob on the line. I practiced doing this. I went to the Verizon site to find out how to conference calls. So what this means is I'm going to be pressing a button here. I'm going to be calling them. Then I'm going to press another button to bring us all together. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So stand by here just a second. Let me get dim mute. Dim mute, I like to call them. So if we get disconnected, don't call me back, okay? I'll call you back, all
okay.
right?
Okay, we're all set okay, up so here on this number.
Yeah, stand by just a second here. Let me see. Here we go. So you know, presuming this works, we should be all together in about 30 seconds here. So
sounds
here we
good
go.
To me.
Sounds like a plan here, to me.
Flash. All right. 1, 2, 3. Let's see. Mobile number. Okay, here we go.
I heard a click. Did we miss out? No, he's still on there.
To call Bob.
Hello.
Bob, how you doing?
Doing okay.
Hey, Dinky, are you there?
Yeah, Bob, this is Dinky and Nancy here with me. We're in Plymouth at the podcast house, as I call it. Oh, it's a wonderful place.
Okay.
Let me grab Patty. She'll be...
I can't believe this. I'm absolutely blown away.
We haven't talked to Patty since, what, the mid-70s.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now listen, everybody.
Hang on. Let me go for speakers here. Hold on.
Okay.
Hey. Okay. Also, we have an out. We have to be somewhere around the top of the hour.
Oh, no problem.
Around 4.
We've only got three stories to talk about, I think, with you guys, because Sam said that you remember three particular times that you played the channel, and I said.
That's possible, yeah.
And I don't mean play the channel. You work the channel recorded and that kind of stuff.
Face-to-face, climax, and bow, wow, wow.
Oh, my God.
Well, if that's the case, you're on your board too, Sam?
I'm on the phone. I was telling you I like to do this through my Neumann mic, but if I sound just fine through the phone... Which would you like?
Well, I like you here already. I mean, you sound good and sound sharp and everything, and Bob sounds great. I mean, you got it sorted there, you know.
And yeah, we're all good.
Yeah.
So. Hey, so Patty, Nancy.
Hi. Hi there.
Patty.
Did you say Nancy? Is that Nancy?
That is. Oh, my God, Patty.
Oh, my God, Nancy. Yes, hi.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. My favorite memory of you is at the Esplanade, driving our Citroën, getting past all the traffic. You were amazing. And then you told me you had driven a cab in New York, and that explained it all.
Oh, that's true. I remember that. That was a fun show.
It was.
Well, after all of this, I want to reconnect with you and Dinky sometime. We'll get together.
That'll
be really
awesome.
Fun.
Oh, yeah. We'd love that.
We'd love that. We love that.
Are you still in Plymouth, by the way?
Yeah, yeah. We've moved a little bit further down into Manomet, and we're
nice.
We're in our little house and stuff, and so far happy here. Except I'm doing dialysis every day, except Wednesdays.
4 days a week.
We changed to 4 days a week now, and but that's okay.
Wow.
I've gone through many illnesses over the years, but. The most important thing is that we're here talking with the birthday boy and you and he'll be
Oh, that's right.
Bob.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Yeah. My last year in my 70s.
Oh, Sam, that's the good stuff, you know. It's fine. I mean, you move on, you plod on, and you have fun with what you can do at that time. And then you move on to something else and do something else. And that's why we're doing this. So here, let me just start.
According to George Harrison, you get to the end of it all and you just change your clothes when you die.
I like that.
I like that one. I like that one. So let me just start this off and let you know what we do. Welcome to Two Pints in the Corner, Sam Copper, Bob DeMuth, and Paddy Perry, where we've not talked with and seen, for quite a few decades and stuff. But that's how life is when you're on the road or working and living life. And that's the most important thing. So today we're going to talk about channel shows that Sam and Bob did together. With Starfleet, the portable studio, it was a bus full of stuff and good stuff. And I tried to help rewire it, but you get a better engineer than me in there, like Bob. It not only rewired, he worked it every day and worked with Sam every day, so it worked in advantage for both of you, I think. And it's just wonderful stuff. So you guys. Sam, let's have Bob talk about the first show that you guys did together that you've got on your list there.
Well, I think the first one was January 8th in 83, Bow Wow Wow. And I have to be brutally honest, I don't remember the band. Bob, what do you remember of it?
I mean, I remember their music at the time. I remember working at the channel. You know, we did so many shows, it's sort of hard sometimes to separate one from the other.
Exactly.
You know, and so much broadcast. Now I think Bow Wow Wow, I think all three of these were live broadcast.
Yeah.
They were live broadcast.
I also remember,
Live broadcast because of Bow Wow Wow, and then Little Rodney C was opening, and Orpheus Oedipus was MC.
So I was about to say it's most likely a BCN show.
It was
a BCN live show. You know, Bow Wow Wow was one of the, one of Eddie's favorite bands at the time.
Yeah.
So he loved it, and he loved hosting them. You know, the channel was it's a pretty easy place for us to work. You know, because we were able to, if I'm remembering correctly, there was an alley right along the water. Behind the stage, that was the
car park and what have you. The alley I think you're talking about is in Echo Place, which is the other side of the channel, which is that long strip alley there. And where you're parked is just right out the back door, and no problem, get the wires in there. You could go out the back and have a crab Louie and stuff like that.
Of course, back in the day, there were periods of time. Late 70s, early 80s, where we were doing as many as 2 to 3 live broadcasts a week on BCN.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Paradise was a lot harder in terms of cable runs until we did so many shows on the Paradise that eventually Bob installed a permanent multi-pin connector from just behind the marquee there right into the stage.
Perfect.
But as you say, at the, so all we had to do was pull up the bus and plug in and run a cable across the sidewalk to the marquee. But the channel, as you say, was so much easier because it was so, you could park right next to the stage.
See, that's the beauty of that place. And not only that, Bob's right, there was just so much going off. The scene was incredible every day, no matter where. I'm sure you guys went to see a show or two that was not work. It didn't work. Is that right, Bob? You went to see some...
I'll be honest with you. I did not go down to the channel. I'm sure I went. I must have gone to a show or two, but I can't necessarily recall. You know, I didn't go out to shows so much that I didn't work at. It's one of those things for me that when you worked in it, and it was just sort of hard for me on a night off to want to go out and see a show when I work so many shows.
That makes sense.
I completely agree.
I agree.
In fact, I got very kind of spoiled by, you know, by working shows, so that even to this very day, to go to a live music show, I find myself sitting in the chair wanting to get up and get backstage and do what I like to do.
It's different now. It's different. You can't get even the radio. Even Carter was saying it was just difficult to get backstage these days, unless you knew the band personally, because nobody would let you anywhere around anymore. It's just a different cycle, and it's run by different people. It's not run by musicians anymore. It's run by business people, and that's all they know. We don't want anybody other than our people in the back, and that's about it, you know.
One of the other interesting things about the early 80s and doing, you know, live broadcasts, you know, for me is, you know, they would let someone like me or Sam, you know, not one of their producers or not one of their engineers. The bands were thrilled to let us mix a show because they wanted exposure on the radio.
Exactly.
And by the mid 80s, you know, that just sort of ended. You know, they started sending, you know, by 84, 85, 83, 4, 5, they started, you know, sticking their producers or their engineers in there. And these are people who may have been fantastic house mixers, but it's a different thing mixing for the radio.
Oh, totally.
You know, you don't have a PA, you know, you're not filling that in. It's a discrete mix. And so the whole, you know, landscape changed. You know, I tell people about that time in my life is I had the best job in the world. You know, being able to go and work and mix bands that I was listening to on the radio. And, you know, I felt my job was just to render them, was to make the live broadcast sound as close to the album as possible. I wasn't trying to produce it. I wasn't trying to my own, you know, fingerprint on it. Just, you know, make it sound good.
That's precisely, you know, when I talk with people about those times, I would tell people, you know, a mix for someone's living room, a mix that's going to work in someone's car or in headphones or whatever, is completely different than a mix that's, you know, tuned to the acoustics of a given room.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, you know, when you're in a venue and you've got acoustic instruments and drums and electric instruments, you're going to be boosting the acoustic instruments and the vocals and stuff more for the room than you are the drums and the loud electric instruments. So that mix doesn't work in someone's living room. And so I tell people, we were attempting to do the kind of mix that would be done from a 24-track tape, taken back to a studio and worked on for weeks to remix it, to make it. We wanted to do that in real time.
Yeah.
And I was really good at that in the early days. But there's nothing better than a guy who passes on, you know, some knowledge and whatever, a teacher, to have the student get even better. And Robert L. DeMuth is the best freaking live to air mixer I've ever worked with. So there you go.
Hey, that's a good one, Bob. I like that one. Because, yeah, there's a whole different ball game. For me, I'm a live sound engineer that created albums live because I didn't mix the PA. I mixed music reproduction, which is a whole different ball game. And there weren't just filling in the blanks of this amplifier in there. I was mixing things where the amplifiers were panning left and right, the drums were always in stereo. But in the channel, I just let everyone that was learning mixing live-like, I'd help them, I'd help them out. Even today, David Wentling, who used to work for me there and is now at Berkeley, teaching kids how to do that at Berkeley when they have the sessions there and what have you. And how to do it the real way, not the electronic way that's done now. People walk into a venue right now with an iPad and they go, they click this, they click that. That's one through zeros. There's no warmth in any of that. We're humans. We lead analog. That's why you did such a good job, Bob, because you're mixing for the radio, but also mixing it in like an album right away and having people like Sam with you that wants this and wants that. And Oedipus coming in and torturing you and things like that. But at the end of the day, it was you. and you were creating that whole thing, which is a different kind of style of mixing than it is an live mixing. It's just like studio. When I go and did Steely Dan stuff in the studio, it was totally different than my live stuff, which blew people away, you know? And that's what I loved, is that live environment that I could mix as though I was it was a studio to me. And that's a whole different thing, whereas you didn't hear many mixes from me in the channel, because I had every night there was someone coming through with the band, and I let them use everything. That's why I got a Yamaha board in there instead of my boards, because my boards didn't have any numbers on it. It was full of hundreds of knobs and black knobs and this, that, and the other, and you used the ear. And people didn't use the ear. They used the graph thing. They used this. They used 1 through 10. And I went like, nah. You know, so it's different, and I agree with you, and I that's one of the reasons we talk about radio as a different monkey. But the monkey's good, because if it's done right like you guys did, it's warm. The people want you to do it. The people want you to do this stuff, you know. So
by the way, Bob's mix of The Police at the Orpheum, and you know, live to WBCN,
yeah.
Live to quarter inch, 15 IPS, 2-track tape, and when A&M decided they wanted to release a live Police disc, they released a double disc set in the late 90s, and disc one of The Police Live is simply Bob's mix.
I love it.
It went live on the area. They did nothing else to it.
That's the key. That's the key, Bob. That's the key. You put your heart and soul and love into the damn thing and give it your all. And whether it be a mic that's divided linear or whatever, or a channel that's starting to go boop, 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 or whatever, you figured it out. Boop, down, up, down, next. Let me do that sorting later. But here we go, you know. And it's like, when it's that kind of strength and that kind of life, you should be put on albums. No messing with that kind of stuff, you know. And I feel that way. I feel that way big time. And that today they don't do that. Most of the stuff for engineers is on flash drives. You put the flash drive in the machine and it does it all itself. Every damn song is click, track, and flash drive, and the band has to play to it. And the lights then automatically go on that flash drive too. So it's all ones and zeros, not human. And a human is the real way to go. And I'm glad you did that. I'm glad you got that one. That was a good one.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about today versus then is I think it was a different time in music.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I hear stuff today, you know, with very few exceptions. There's too much repetition. I mean, part of rock and roll is repetition. You know, part of, you know, the verse, the refrain, you know, there is a lot of repetition, but you know, we didn't sample, musicians in those days didn't sample everything. You're not hearing one artist doing a sample of you know, some other artist 20 years earlier and taking those sounds and making it part of their music. And, you know, there seems to be, with few exceptions, there's a lack of originality in today's music. I mean, I guess if I were into rap music, I might take issue with that. I guess it's original, but some of that stuff, I just don't hear the musicality in it.
No,
if musicality is a real term.
I'm with you.
Kiwi sounded cool.
Well, I'm with you. It's disappeared. A lot of the vibe that was created was because of the community, the thousands of kids that, and girls and boys that used to not only come to the channel, but go to every club in town and enjoy the music from, whether it be the local Stompers or whether it be the local Fools or whatever, local Charlie Farron and all the people that's been on the podcast so far. They love them, and they still do. They still go out because they can't get that with the newer bands. You know, you've got Dropkick Murphys as the new lot, but they're still playing old-style material and old things. So you get the warmth from that lot, you know. It's what we all grew up with was a different genres. I mean, for me, with Fleetwood and the Blues, with Peter Green, it was a different monkey, all totally. And I loved every minute of that part of it. I loved every minute of what we did in the channel, even though it was crazy and you never knew what was coming around that day because there were so many bands and stuff. But what bands other than you did Bow Wow Wow? Okay, what's the other one now, Sam?
Oh, let's see here. Climax was April 22nd, 87, and Face to Face was January 1st, 85. Was that a New Year's Eve show?
85, let's have a look.
I remember.
January 1st, 85 was The Allies, Supreme, The End, Ultra Motives. Oh, there was a right time on WFNX Presents The Stores the next day. January 1st.
My date is wrong.
Yeah.
Your date must be wrong, Sam. I do remember doing a full show at the channel. The Climax, I don't recall. And I think 87 was probably after my time. I think I had moved off to LA by then.
I don't know who would be doing it if you weren't there, but
well, I remember you there on a couple occasions when I was there, and then one time I don't think I was there when you came through, but that was 87, you said 87 on January 1st.
That's what I have on the list, and again, I could be wrong. I'm wrong once a month, and it's early April, so you know it's painful that if I have to have my one time being wrong in the month so early in April. But you know,
and for me, what's fascinating is as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, I could still remember most every show, and maybe not photographically, but if I were to look at a list, I'd remember the show, and I'd remember, oh, okay, I remember the instances. But that's fading these days. So that's just part of life.
Is there any show that really, other than the ones you worked, if you came at another time, is there any show there that you really enjoyed, like a Roy Orbison or somebody in that caliber or whatever, you know? Charlie Watts?
You know, I probably went to more shows at the channel than Bob did on off nights, simply because I would go see people who were friends or something. But I do remember, seeing Robin Lane play there. And I was just talking with her this afternoon earlier.
Oh, wow.
And I said, do you remember these shows? And we were really trying to, both of us, remember. But I know that a couple shows that she played there, you know, after the Chartbusters kind of disbanded, and she reformed it with the guys from Rhode Island called The Shake. And they played a couple times, I think, in 82 and 83 there. And then later on, we both sort of remember the Chartbusters playing there again when Peter Hoffman replaced Leroy, but we couldn't remember the date. And then I remember seeing, of course, Face to Face there, and the Elevators, because they were Western Mass guys that I had known growing up, you know. And then, of course, Meatloaf played there, and I had some history with him.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking of Meatloaf and places like that you guys would come.
Yeah, that was a great show. I mean, I was very close friends with Jim Steinman when he was writing that material. I was living in the same apartment with him when he wrote all that Meatloaf stuff, or a lot of it. And so I, you know, I've always been a Meatloaf fan, even though he's so annoying. although he's no longer, so I won't say how annoying he really is, but and you know, there were a lot of interesting shows there. I always went if NRBQ was playing, because of course, once again, being a Western Mass girl, NRBQ played like, you know, every week it seemed around Western Mass. So when I moved to Boston, I always go to those shows, and those are always great. But it was a great venue for, you know, just a big old open place where you could, it wasn't crowded and like the Rack or some of the other places that we were, forced to be in at times.
Just before we go off on another level, Meatloaf. On one show, this is a story about Meatloaf. Meatloaf was going on stage. They just started, and Meatloaf was going on stage, and he realized he needed to go to the bathroom, big time. So, He got him to vamp up and got him to do all this stuff. He came out the back door. One of our production guys took him round the back and down into the office and to the bathroom in the office. And he must have sat there for quite a while because he had his mic with him and he was singing a couple of times along the way and stuff. and then he got off the toilet, came and jumped on the stage, and the production guy goes, took the toilet seat. So we have the toilet seat of Meatloaf.
By the way, I have a photograph still in my photos file of Meatloaf and Tony Berardini. Another person or two. It was taken inside the bus. The Starfleet bus.
Yeah.
So I still have that photo.
Was that the Paradise show?
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Was that the Paradise show?
I'm not sure. The photos are not. Since it was inside the bus, I don't know.
Well, you were in Paradise more than anything, though, at one point, because it was so close with the BCN at that time and what have you. And,
I spent a lot of nights, both, well, you know, we originally parked behind, but then we parked in front a lot of nights, one side or the other of that place.
Remind me, because I'm remembering the smaller room at the channel.
The Necco Place.
Yeah, I don't remember what it was called.
Necco Place.
That little room, it was the back room that was just nothing in it. I mean, the lads had food stuff going in there and what have you. And a lot of the big bands would come in there, and if they were coming in at night, like you two guys were all in the back room before Necco Place was built. Then we built Necco Place, and it became a really nice little folk, come jazz, come everything room, and people enjoyed that little place. They were lining up for it on certain nights, you know.
I remember some shows there. Ace of Bradbury used to play there.
Ace, all the time, yeah. They're painted.
Yeah,
they're painted
up. Oh my goodness! Yeah.
Now you're talking some heavy Boston quality musicians all the way through that lot. That one of you guys that you've talked about right now has got the tops in my book from Boston, and just with the right engineering, the right quality of performance, and everything along the way. And you guys, I think, must have done a New Year's Eve party that went live, and it went on BCN, and I'm trying to remember which year it was, but it could have been Face to Face, it could have been one of them guys, but anyway.
Well, that's what Tim said, 85, I think 85 New Year's Eve.
85 in the... 80, oh yeah, well, have a look. I've got all the damn sheets in front of me. Face to Face, it says December 31st, Face to Face with New Man and the Buddy System with DJ Janet.
That sounds very cool.
DJ Janet Planet, and that night, you know, because we had DJs and whatever. That's 31st to 85, okay?
Yeah, that would be about right. Their first album came out.
Yeah.
Oh, is that when it came?
That's right around when their first album came out, I believe, maybe the fall, something like that. Yeah.
December 31st, 1986, The Cramps with DJ Tammy Hayden.
Oh, goodness.
There was so many fun shows that was recorded there, like you said, whether it be you guys or whether it be WGBH guys, but you still work together with this lot. So that's what made me happy about all that stuff. I didn't have to worry about radio because there's people like you, Bob, and Sam running around here doing the stuff. I didn't have to worry about it. And And I remember transformers that we used to go down of telephone lines at that point that you guys brought in and what.
Oh, absolutely. The
200,
the 110 C coils.
Yeah, that's the ones. It was in the back for a while. I remember that kind of stuff. It was great. We're all ready to go. Let's plug in and go to BCN now. We say that stuff, you know, every time we saw that.
I think
cable.
That Bruce Macomber used to do a lot of the recordings out on that side of town.
Yeah. That's from WGBH, right?
No, Colby.
Oh,
WGBH.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. That's now it's all come back. You remember things go away and then come back after many years. Oh,
I don't remember what Bruce's company was called, Sam. Do you?
The tip of the tongue, but it's not there. I don't have it.
Yeah, I don't know where that.
It's close, but I'm going to see Bruce Macomber tomorrow night because he's doing some sort of visual project with Yardbirds, and the Yardbirds are in Fall River tomorrow night.
Oh, the Narrows. The Narrows is a good.
The Narrows, that's right.
That's a good place to do that kind of stuff. Everybody around here, even Ed Neuter, a photographer around here and stuff, they love to go there and see some talent.
And it's a wonderful room. You know, it's typical one of those old New England factories that they've converted. And there's so much wonderful wood in there that the acoustics in the room are really, really nice.
And that's why they have good artists in there and stuff. There's very few of the newer stuff that can get very boring, like you said. I mean, as you said, Bob, I don't know whether you know this, but if you go and listen to anything that comes out of Nashville, everything on the drums is used on a sampler, and it's the same snare, the same hi-hat on every song, every single song. And that's how they do it. They just use this, and then they go in the studio and they put in a few acoustic instruments around it, but it's the same sound on every song, the same, and it's not the quality that they used to have in respect of...
Well, also, it takes away from the individual identity of the band and their music, to me.
Exactly.
I mean, part of me can say, okay, I can understand wanting, okay, you've got the perfect kick, the perfect snare, the perfect hat, you know, the perfect drum kit, so why should you use another one? But as I said a second ago, that's part of the identity of the band. Not every snare is a snap. Sometimes it's a ring, you know?
It depends on what you got. A hollow snare, you got a piccolo, or you've got a big fat one, you know? And then you've got people who don't know how to really use them. They know how to play them, but they don't know how to use them in respect of the tightening of the skin and the right thing and this. But you get people like, well, I work with Mick, Billy Cobham, you know, they knew how to use drums and tighten them and make sure they sounded good before you got to them on the sound, you know.
Hey, Dinky, let me just ask you, did you ever work with Charlie Watts?
No, only time we did the show at the Channel with his orchestra. But you're talking of someone who was absolutely amazing drummer. Not only that, his collection of other people's equipment, drums and the things is just mind-boggling. You know, every famous drummer that ever lived, he's got one of their kits, or he bought one of their kits and stored it in the warehouse, the house. And it's just amazing amount of stuff he's got. And he was a classic drummer, not a rock drummer, but a jazz drummer. And he changed it into the jazz into rock, and then he go back to jazz whenever he felt like having playing the good stuff, you know. And stuff, even though his rock stuff that he did with the Stones, man, oh my goodness, it's just absolutely wonderful. And you know. What can I say about Charlie? Charlie is just wonderful. I mean, there are certain musicians that I did work with Stevie Winwood, when I did the Berlin album with Lou Reed and stuff in the 73. I had Ainsley come up, Ainsley Dunbar, another drummer, B.J. Thomas, all the really, you know, Jack Bruce on bass and all that stuff and whatever. Really fine musicians, and they were let to go. Bob Ezrin, the producer for Lou, just let them go. And when you sat there and listened to this stuff, if you didn't press the button and now record, you might as well forget being an engineer, because there were just dynamics that came out of this stuff. And even when they were playing around, was just wonderful, you know. And then here's another quick one about Bob Ezrin. Bob Ezrin brought in this wonderful thing. He realized that he could get a sound better than everybody using Neumanns and Sonys on the drums. Forget all that stuff. He thought the Rhodes sound of 57s on toms was phenomenal. And he did. Every one of that Lou Reed album, that Berlin album, has got 57s on the toms, 57s on the floor tom, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it just like it's mixed like it was in the studio, not in the studio, but in the live field. And that's why that album can sound so good. It's a musician's album. And the musicians love to be able to try to copy some of this stuff off of there, because it was played excellent by all those quality musicians, you know? And let freedom.
No, if you know how to place a mic, you know, it's 90% mic placement, you know. Well,
totally.
90% the musician.
90%. Hey, man, by the way, you know, before the Starfleet bus, the old Crab Louie bus, when I started, I had a Tascam 10 board with only 8 channels in it. Those boards could go up to 12, if I remember correctly, but I could only afford 8. And I had 2 Shure mixers, right?
Which
I would then add into it. So I got up to about 16 channels total, right? No processing whatsoever.
No, you don't need
any. I didn't even have splitters at that point, okay?
That's right.
So I go out, and my very first recording is Maria Muldaur opening for Bonnie Raitt. And so that was at Wesleyan College. And 2 months later, I'm doing Buddy Guy and Junior Wells at Shabu Inn in Connecticut. And right after that, nobody, Blue Oyster Cult. In all cases, and we're talking 16 channels at most.
Yeah.
No processing. In many cases, having to double mic because they don't have splitters.
Yeah.
And I cannot believe I'm stroking myself right now, because I listened to that Buddy Guy Junior Wells thing, and it's like, I hate to say it, but it's a damn perfect mix.
Yeah. There you go.
And it's about mic placement, as you say. It's totally about mic placement.
It's totally about mic placement.
Also,
Go on, Bob.
Well, also, I just want to interject a little bit that it's about mic placement and it's about the musicians, but more than anything, to me, it's about the ears of the person
mixing. Exactly.
Because one of the things, and Dinky, you mentioned dynamic, you know, one of the things that's really missing in live performances now, we go to some shows, we went to one the other night, and we sat behind the mixing console in Atlantic City in this really lovely room, the music box, listening to Todd Rundgren singing the songs of Burt Bacharach, and the mix was horrible. I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, how can you screw this up, you know? But the guy had, it was all computers, you know, he's looking at computers.
What?
And computer screens and just not listening.
No,
he's
they
missing,
don't.
Two women singing, you can't hear their vocals, you know, and that's often the frustration when we go to a show is we're just like,
it's also the digital boards don't give you the warmth, you see, and they work to the ones and zeros on either the iPad setting up the thing.
Exactly.
They're
using the formula. And the sort of the numbers, as you say, and not listening to what's going on.
They're not listening to what's going on, the room, or any of that stuff at all. It's just, that's what the computer says. This is, it's got to be right. And you've got to check this process. Yeah. Oh, you need a gate on this. You need that on that. It's bull crap. Get perfect what Sam did. Perfect. With the cymbal knobs. Look, come on, Woodstock, for instance, the whole thing were on Shure Vocal Master, them Shure little mixers. I mean,
I'll tell you one thing, in terms of the processing equipment that we had, you know, in the late 70s and the 80s, I don't know anybody who worked compressors and limiters and reverb better than Bob. I got to tell you, I used to be in awe of what you did, Bob.
It's that gated reverb from the 80s. Everything had it on. I was like, yeah, right. Yeah. It's like you're saying, you went to see someone and every time you will come away from these shows because of the use of the digital equipment and because of the ones and zeros, even if they don't use the iPad. I did a show 10, 12 years ago now down in New York City at BB King's with my friends Spanky McFarland and Denny Diaz and all my friends down there under Spanky and our gang. And it was the worst sounding thing I'd ever heard in my life. I'm hearing the bass go, pfft, pfft, pfft. You know, I'm saying, that's like a fat speaker's blown here. Oh, no, you've got to do that. I'm saying, but that's, look, you clip 1 dB and the mixer says, screw you. You know, it's just terrible. So you couldn't mix it. I was just so disgusted. I said, yeah, give me one of them little Shure Vocal Masters, I'll be fine. You know, something like that. But that's why I used to mix on the WEM with Fleetwood, because the WEM just had volume, input attenuation, a bass control, a mid control, a high end control, and then on the top, I could either use it as a super high or as a separate send for like tape echo, which we use the WEM copycat or stuff like that. But then when it got into the gated reverbs and all the XPX90s and 900s and all that kind of stuff, and then all the other stuff came in, and you could program it this way, that way. All you were doing is programming. You were doing nothing to do with the sound except distorting it ever all along the way on the cycle. You got to give it raw. Boy, like you said, doesn't it feel good to listen to some of them stuff from that time period? It just feels incredible.
Oh, God, yeah.
I've got a whole bunch of them.
Bob, what were your favorite pieces of outboard equipment that helped you make the wonderful mixes you did?
I mean, I just used whatever we had. I mean, we had those
DBX.
We had DBX 161s.
Right.
We had URI LA4s, compressor limiters.
We had an AKG reverb, right?
We had an AKG spring reverb box,
right.
And then we graduated to an Eventide digital delay.
Yeah.
Which really was it was an early digital box, but it really was a great box. It sounded like, you know, analog stuff. But I can't remember the name. There were those modular compressor limiter gates, maybe Alice or something.
Avid.
You know,
I know what you're talking of. I forget the name myself. You're right.
If I looked at a picture of the over the board, then we could probably figure it out.
That's right.
But you know, for me, it wasn't necessarily what the equipment was as much. Normally, it was an analog limiter, limiter or compressor. Just using it right. You know, I was just trying to control the dynamic of the live sound.
Yeah.
You know, so that it didn't overload the board.
For,
you know, that's it.
Especially for radio, you need to do that, you know.
That's all I was trying to do, you know, and so that, well, you know, we had a Dinky, you'll appreciate this from the, you know, you're putting the system in at the Paradise. We had a Tangent 4 in the bus. And it was very forgiving. It was very warm and fuzzy, but when that warm and fuzzy started to crackle at the top end, it wasn't a good thing.
No. No, the IC started opening up and the capacitors started opening. We actually just had a board here that did the same thing, a brand new board. The 1 week it works wonderful, and then the next week it starts going and doing the whole rigmarole, and then to find out it's some kind of IC or some kind of a power thing that was going on inside. And since we got the new one here, it's what a our quality. And this is same kind of manufacturer that owned the boards is called a Rode, but this particular one is a Mackie Rode, and that because they bought Mackie, And not only did they buy Mackie, they used their inputs. They used the quality of the channels that Mackie's always had and got better and better over the years. And so when it comes to this little board, it's crystal clear. The dynamics is there. There's no huffing and puffing or any of that stuff. And it's mixed between analog and digital. And the digital part is all the graphic stuff and all that stuff you can use. But you don't use that. Just playing. All he's using is the Shure mic that I'm talking into, the Bluetooth on the telephone, and another Shure mic over there. So that's it. And you don't need anything. Yeah. You don't need anything crazy. And this young lad here, Chris, is learning how to do all this stuff right better than most people right now, because he's learning to understand that you can't just use the digital stuff and do the clicking. You've got to go into a room and go, you know, shout like I used to do in every single room as they walk in the door to hear the ambience of the room. And then you take it from there, knowing how many people come in that place later, you know. And that's what you did too when you used to come in the channel. You listen to what was going off there and how was it canyon that day, or was it a solid rather than a, you know, that kind of frequencies. And really, it was the way it should be for a show. And it kicked butt, the whole thing on the system, two systems in there, a focal one and a music reproduction one. But the quality of everything was good. And right now, we had one of the guys, Iggy Pop recorded in there, and it's an album. Went straight to an album, just straight from the board. They made an album because it was done right. The engineer did the right thing by using it as a giant stereo near-field system. And that's what Landau was doing with Bob Dylan and people like that. When I did Chris Whitley, Landau was producing it like that. When I did him out on the West Coast, Landau was absolutely freaking out, saying, "Oh my goodness, you're doing a better one than me in these things." When we had Warren Zevon and Chris Whitley out together and stuff, it was like, "Wow, this is really good stuff," you know. So it's because you're doing it. Anyway, I better shut up and let you guys talk because it's really your time.
Well, we're close to running out of time.
Yeah, we are, because of you guys who got to get out.
Hey, by the way, my cell phone just rang, and you know, it, cosmically, the guy who was calling is Norm Weiner.
Oh.
And by the way, Norm, you know, CBS, of course, shut down all of their music stations back in 2016.
Yeah.
But Norm programmed, after leaving BCN, he went to KSAN in San Francisco, but then to Chicago, he programmed WXRT in Chicago for a record 37 years.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing. That length of time doing that. Oh, wow.
Yeah. A relatively important market, Chicago, I think. Anyway.
I would say so at that point.
So anyway, this has been a lot of fun. I mean, there's an awful lot more Old Home Week we could continue with, I'm sure.
Oh, we haven't got to Piney yet. We haven't got to Piney.
Yeah, I know. But let me just one thing I do want to throw in, if Bob and Patty have a moment to comment on this. To me, there are two different philosophies in terms of mixing live music for record or for broadcast. Okay, one is you want vocals in particular to sound kind of hall-like, like you're in the room and you're hearing vocals hall-like. Yeah. Or the way I like it, and I think the way Bob liked it, because he always mixed it that way, much more presence, much more on mic and not a hall sound. To me, a hall sound, you know, even on a professional recording and some professional, I mean, Ed Stasium, when we worked with him, he tended to mix the vocals with a hall-y sort of a sound. And I don't like that. I want it on mic. And what do you guys think?
I agree.
Yeah. Well, you taught me how to, you know, to balance it, you know, what the balance should be. And I mean, it wasn't, you know, when we would drop down to
drop it down to mono. You got to hear the vocal. The vocal's got to cut through.
Yeah.
And you got to understand what they're saying. You don't necessarily have to understand every word, but you want to understand, you know, 9 out of 10 words.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, effects are a great thing, is that, you know, the whole sound. I mean, some bands, you know, there were a lot of musicians' vocal sound is based on what I think you're calling a Hawley sound, or, you know, I'll call it based on that effect. Mm-hmm. And if that's what the musician wanted their voice to sound like, you know, that's what I would try to do. But you don't want to get lost. You don't want to get lost in the hall.
That's right.
You want to be able to hear them.
We can't keep going on it, but, you know, then there's the story of doing Roger Waters at the Radio City Music Hall, and he had a technology he was developing called holophonic sound.
Yeah.
He insisted that we take his mix from his head sitting in the middle of the audience with two mics where ears would be, and we said, well, we're going to do our separate mix. And we'll figure out once we hit air. I think this was with Westwood One, actually, Bob.
Wow.
And we ended up taking our own board mix. Roger's holophonic sound did not work.
No, it didn't sound. I mean, it was not. Not only was it not broadcast quality, it wasn't recordable.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the head thing. I remember that one. Okay, we should.
Yeah, exactly. The head.
We're missing Patty, but, I mean, I'm sure she's got more to tell you.
Well, let me just say one thing, Dinky, because I learned to mix from you. Remember the story, I had done a studio engineering class because I was mixing my brother's band and what I was doing. So I took that class, was doing, you know, local stuff. And then I did that in Orleans tour, and then came back home and worked in a recording studio, and I really hated it because it was just too confined with strange people in the middle of nowhere in Stockbridge. And Warren Wallace is the one who called me up one day.
No!
I remember that.
No!
Yeah, and he said, you know, because he was the road manager on the Orleans tour, then I had done work with him, and then so he said, what are you doing? I'm working in the studio, don't really enjoy it, it's really confining and scary because it's a bunch of, like, I'm getting sexually harassed all the time and
all the time.
And so he said, he called me up and he said, I'm sending you to Plymouth to live with Dinky and Nancy Dawson, and Dinky's going to teach you how to mix live shows. And so I went, and, you know, it was Michael McLaughlin and that kid Patrick and a whole crazy entourage of people living in your house there. And Amanda was like 4 years old. But we, you know, we did all these shows all summer long. And I remember you putting me at the board at some festival somewhere. I don't even remember who I was mixing or whatever. And you walked away. You said, you figure it out. And there was nothing, like you say, it wasn't labeled, you know, and you said you listen and you mix, you feel it and you listen.
Exactly.
And that really taught me how to do it, how to really pay attention and to listen and mix with your ears and not with what, you know, then, you know, the things I had learned was like, well, you should do this and you should do that. You're like, that's baloney. You listen with your ears and you feel what you're doing. And really that's how I learned how to mix properly. So I thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome, Paddy, because it's true. That's how you do it. We only had one lady that came through, two ladies, I think, that came through the channel, and they both had the same concept. They would work on the stage and they would come out and mix and stuff. They would do the same thing, no ifs, no buts. They learned all that, and they enjoyed it. And I was like, yeah, this is great. I'm glad that they're doing that. That's why I got them a big Yamaha 2000 at that point, you know, just on there just to do that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, this is good.
Yeah, well, I thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, Paddy. I thank you for all the crazy stuff that we've done and stuff. And I've heard crazy stuff in your life, but you've gone through it all. Came out and you've gone with Bob, and then you've done this, you know, going back to school and stuff and learning a bit. That whole stuff is wonderful because it changes your progress.
Well, you know, another time, I mean, she was crazy enough to go from rock and roll into politics.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we heard.
Not such a difficult transition, really, but anyway. So, but we'll, Sam, you'll give me the information, and I'll contact Dinky and Nancy at some point.
Okay.
We'll chat and stuff more. But the bottom line is that you're doing great. You sound great. And Bob, thank you for looking after this wonderful woman, and also giving Sam some of the best mixes he's ever heard in his life. Because basically, Sam, it wouldn't do nothing without talking with you. He said, "I did it." The last time we talked for this, we talked for that, and last minute he says, "Ah." You know, it's Bob. We got to talk with Bob. He knows the stuff backwards and stuff. I'm saying, yeah. And I'm glad we did it. We made this contact. This is great. This is great. Thank you, guys. And I just want to say,
thank you.
You're welcome. And this is Two Pints in the Corner signing off right now. And we will be on and out and listening to good music played live. But all of us at some point in time, and so we can reminisce on what we did and what we did wrong and what we did right. Just like that, Paddy. That was great. That was a good one. I appreciate that one.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, and have a good one, you guys, and we'll be in touch with everything. Okay.
Okay. Bye.